Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. This week I'm speaking with Arjun Makajani, President and Senior Engineer at the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Arjun is the author of Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a roadmap for US energy policy produced in 2007. The roadmap is the first analysis of a transition to a US economy based completely on renewable energy without the use of fossil fuels or nuclear power. Arjun is also the principal author of the first overall study of the energy efficiency potential of the US economy in 1971, the first global analysis of energy and agriculture in the Third World in 1975, and the first independent assessment of radioactivity emissions from a nuclear weapons plant in 1989. Arjun holds a PhD from the University of California, Berkeley, where he specialised in the area of plasma physics as applied to controlled nuclear fusion. He also holds a Master's in Electrical Engineering from Washington State University and a Bachelor of Engineering from the University of Bombay in India. Arjun has published numerous reports and articles and has received a variety of awards, including the Josephine Butler Nuclear Free Future Award in 2001 and the Plowshares Hero from the Plowshares Fund in 2006. Arjun Makajani, thanks for joining us on this program, If You Love This Planet.
Thank you, Helen. We cannot fail to say that you and David Freeman inspired my book, Carbon Free and Nuclear Free.
Well, then let's go back to your original history with David Freeman. Arjun, tell us how you met him, who is he, and what happened in the White House during the Carter years?
Well, David Freeman is a real father, in my opinion, of energy policy in the United States. When he worked in the White House in the 1960s for Presidents Johnson and Nixon, he started worrying about oil imports. He thought was jeopardizing U.S. security. And he convinced the Ford Foundation to put up $4 million in those days, more like $20 million today, to study energy policy with efficiency at the center. And as he was planning that project before the first energy crisis, he came to know of my work and hired me, and I worked for him. And we were doing efficiency-based energy policy when the first energy crisis broke. And we were the only independent show in town, as he has written in his foreword to my book, when that crisis broke. And eventually he worked in the Senate Energy Committee and then for President Carter, and our work wound up being the foundation of really the only energy policy this country's ever had that's worth the name. And Dave later on ran the Tennessee Valley Authority, where he put in place the largest efficiency program at the time and has done many wonderful things since.
So the energy crisis was the 1974 oil crisis, was it not?
Yeah, that's when there was the Arab oil embargo on the West, and oil prices suddenly started to rise, and people realized that there was a real price to be paid, both literally and figuratively, in terms of independence of too much oil imports. And there was some progress in those years, but then we lapsed back, and now instead of 35% oil imports, we now import more than 60% of the U.S. oil requirement. And Dave Freeman, a couple of years ago at your energy conference, said that we ought to get rid of oil and get rid of coal and get rid of nuclear and go to renewable energy. And that's what led to the book we're discussing today.
Yes, well, Dave Freeman obviously is a man with a vision. He's a visionary, true visionary and prophet. He's a fascinating character, I have to say. Very funny man. And I indeed was in America at the time of Jimmy Carter and remember him sitting in his cardigan with solar panels on the roof of the White House. And he was moving swiftly to energy efficiency for the nation when Ronald Reagan got elected. And he, of course, removed the solar panels from the White House, turned up the thermostat. Hence, you know, that explains partly why the United States is in the position it's in today, right, Arjun?
Yeah, well, you know, during the Carter years, there were efficiency standards for cars and many other things that were put in place. And then from the mid-80s onward, late 80s, you're quite right, there has been no progress. I think today the average mileage of the U.S. Vehicle fleet is about the same as it was a couple of decades ago or worse. And even though rapid progress was made in the decade after 1973, and so really we have suffered from a lack of leadership. Actually, this has been a bipartisan problem because the situation did not improve during the Clinton years. We did not get more stringent efficiency standards during the Clinton years. And so
why did Clinton not knuckle down and do what was necessary to produce more efficiency, Arjun? What was it that impeded his progress in this area?
Well, I don't think energy was a high priority when he first came to office. I think he had other priorities. And then he, in those days, energy prices were still quite low. They bumped up and down a little bit, but they had gone down since the peaks of the early 80s in terms of oil prices. And the guard of the establishment was down. And then in 1995, the Democrats lost their congressional majority. And I think that Mr. Clinton had to choose his battles, and energy just wasn't one of them. Global warming just wasn't one of them. He did, lead the negotiations for the Kyoto Protocol, but then he did not expend a huge amount of capital to get it ratified. So it just wasn't a top priority with the Clinton administration and with the Republican Congress.
No.
It needed to be.
I think that we need to just enunciate the problem that the U.S. poses to the world. I think it uses, does it not, 25% of the energy of the world, the oil, and it has half of the fleet of the world's 1 billion cars. Is that correct, Arjun?
I think it's a little bit under 25%. We use about a little over 20 million barrels a day, and the world's oil production is somewhat over 85 million barrels a day. So it's almost a quarter.
That's 5% of the Earth's population using a quarter of the world's oil.
That's right. The U.S. is about a little under 5%, actually, of the world's population.
Yeah.
And so, this inequity has long been known. Of course, the per capita consumption of oil is much larger than average also in Europe, and I imagine to some extent in Australia and Japan, although not as much as the United States. But a problem is now no longer a problem of oil and insecurity alone, although we should remember that Alan Greenspan, in his recent book, the former chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve, said that the Iraq war is largely about oil. And so there is the price in human lives and blood and treasure that is being paid over there. But now, you know, the dominant problem with oil and coal is climate change. And we need to solve that. And we need to render these arguments about oil academic by getting rid of fossil fuel.
Okay, so we'll get on to that shortly. But to give another historical perspective, and for those listening, I'm interviewing Dr. Arjun Makajani, who is president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma Park, Maryland. To go back, I'd like you to talk a little, Arjun, about the meetings, how many and which ones that Vice President Cheney had before he composed the present U.S. energy policy. Can you give us a little insight into what he was up to?
One of the most interesting things that happened after Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney first assumed office in 2001 was they put energy on the front burner of the U.S. policy agenda. And I thought that was a very good thing. Mm. Energy needed to be on the front burner of U.S. policy, and they did that by forming a task force that was led by Mr. Cheney and they had a number of meetings in the White House, and they published an energy strategy in, I think it was May 2001. Now, having said that one good thing, I must say I was dismayed at the content of that energy strategy. They met with a few environmental groups, but primarily their discourse had been with oil companies, which was expected given that Mr. Bush came from Texas and both he and Mr. Cheney had strong connections with the oil industry in the time prior to their assuming office. But one of the surprises in the energy report, energy strategy report of May 2001, was the heavy emphasis on nuclear energy. I was not expecting such a central place for nuclear energy because they didn't have prior mention of nuclear energy in such a prominent way during their campaign.
And what about Enron? Wasn't Kenny Lay a major player in those negotiations as well?
Yes, of course, as is known, Mr. Lay had been a good friend of Mr. Bush from their mutual time in Texas. Mr. Lay was one of the wealthiest men around at that time. And, of course, Enron also played a role. You know, the oil industry and gas industry, and Enron was really largely speculating in the oil and gas business and in the electricity business at that time, among other things, did play a role in shaping that policy, deregulation of the electricity sector, giving very heavy emphasis to new exploration for oil in the United States and abroad, including opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve, and also investing and exploring all over the world for oil.
So
that was very, very heavy in the energy policy.
So out of those negotiations came the energy policy. Arjun, can you just tell us what subsidies the oil industry receives from the U.S. Congress and the administration, what subsidies the coal industry receives, and what subsidies the nuclear industry receive compared to the subsidies received by renewable energy forms?
The main benefits that the oil company is currently getting from the U.S. government is pretty big tax breaks. The structure of their taxes over the years, over the last many years, has been changed. And I'm not really familiar with the arcane details of how their taxes are structured. But the new tax breaks that they have gotten in recent years under the Bush administration, and they have been passed by Congress, so it's not just an executive initiative, has been variously estimated in the several billion to several tens of billions of dollars. And there have been initiatives since 2006 when the Democrats regained control of Congress to try to recover some of that money back for better uses like solar energy and so on. But so far, Congress has been unable to prevail in that.
So the Congress and the administration are really victims of the power of the oil lobby, right?
Well, I don't know that the administration can be described as victims of the power of the oil lobby. I mean, they came into office.
Well, they're part of the oil
known
lobby.
As champions of the oil industry. So, and the other side is just so far not able to prevail. Now, in the 2005 Energy Policy Act, which was when some of the provisions of the 2001 document got enacted into law, new subsidies were handed out to the nuclear industry, including a production tax credit of about 1.7 cents a kilowatt hour, subsidies in the licensing process, loan guarantees. In all, it would amount to probably, I think, it was $10 or $12 billion worth of subsidies just for the first few nuclear power plants.
Despite
those subsidies, no nuclear power plant is as yet being built. They're regarded as insufficient by the nuclear industry.
So what power does the nuclear industry, Arjun, have over the Congress and over the administration? I don't quite understand, because most of the nuclear energy's infrastructure is subsidized heavily by the U.S. taxpayer. What is the enormous power that the nuclear energy industry have over the administration and Congress?
Well, currently the main subsidies from the taxpayer are in the form of free insurance to the existing power plants. As you know, they've never been able to buy insurance commercially. Their liabilities are limited by law under the Price-Anderson Act, and then they have to pay essentially nothing for insurance. They pay a very nominal amount for a very modest amount of insurance.
So how much liability? How much does the Price-Anderson Act provide if there is a meltdown at a reactor?
I think that the current limit is something like $10 or $12 billion in total liability, most of which would be covered by the government. And then the government does estimate that the damages could actually be in the hundreds of billions of dollars. So how those damages would be covered, if at all, is currently unclear. Under present law, they're not required to be covered by anybody.
So why, you still haven't answered my question, really. Why or what is this extraordinary power? It's almost like Merlin, you know, the nuclear industry arrives in Washington, everyone lies down in front of them with a red carpet, they march in and get what they ask for, usually, or often.
Helen, it hasn't been quite like that. I don't think the nuclear industry has had a walkover. First of all, they haven't yet, so to speak, they haven't yet had the full extent of the subsidies that they want. That's why they've been talking about a nuclear renaissance now for 3 or 4 years, and they have announced that they're going to build 30 plants, but there hasn't been any concrete pour yet. They've spent a lot of money, mostly the ratepayers' money. Actually, the biggest subsidy in recent years to the nuclear industry has been granted to them by state utility commissions who allowed the excess costs of nuclear power plants from the 80s and 90s to be unloaded onto the ratepayers of regulated utilities so that the few companies now that own lots and lots of nuclear power plants, like Exelon, got them rather cheap, and they're making money hand over fist from these old nuclear power plants, and they're running them at over 90% capacity. And so they have a lot of money to hand around, and they are quite generous contributors to politicians. You know, there are two things that create political will in Washington, and one is votes and the other is money. And so this is not a secret, and they have a huge advertising and public relations budget. But I am quite heartened by the fact that Wall Street is not taken in by the nuclear industry. Nuclear power plants are very expensive, and they have yet to be able to raise the money to start building seriously.
Yeah. And so let's move on from nuclear power then to coal. And we'll talk about coal in a minute, and it's the amount of CO2 it produces in adding to the total greenhouse effect. But how much subsidy does, how much subsidy does the coal industry receive from the federal government, Arjun?
Well, the main subsidies that coal gets is what economists would call a failure to internalize all the costs. Coal is a very polluting fuel. From the mountaintop removal here in the Appalachians, where they literally flatten mountaintops and they dump overburden into the valleys and streams and block the streams. It's absolutely dreadful with toxic material. It's really vandalism of nature. I completely agree. But it's also quite legal. And the rules are being liberalized. So those costs are really incalculable. Of course, the costs of mercury pollution, of sulfur dioxide and acid rain, and the biggest costs, those of carbon dioxide emissions, all of those things are essentially free to the industry, and they keep dumping and dumping and dumping. And we don't really know what that would cost to end it. My estimate is that their external costs, if we were to estimate what it would cost to get rid of this stuff, is really several cents a kilowatt hour. So they're charging about half of what they should be charging if we were to get rid of carbon dioxide.
Yeah, to pay fully for coal-induced electricity. So then, okay, we've talked about coal, we've talked about oil, we've talked about nuclear, and I'm talking to Dr. Arjun Makhijani, incidentally. I'm Helen Caldicott with If You Love This Planet. Arjun is the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. So we've talked about subsidies for coal, for nuclear, for oil, but now, so we're facing a catastrophe potentially globally with global warming. How much then in the energy budget currently is allocated to renewable energy sources with no CO2 production?
Well, wind energy has a production tax credit of 1.7 cents. I don't know how much that adds up to. And solar energy also has some rebate provision. They're actually due to expire this year. But in relation to the total amounts that have been spent subsidizing and developing fossil fuels and nuclear energy, the sums are quite small. I actually don't know the exact numbers.
I think it's about 12 to 15%, isn't it? It's very low.
I don't know. I have never added up the exact numbers of the subsidies. But I do know that as a result of the relative neglect of renewable energy resources, we have only about 1% of the U.S. electricity supply currently that comes from solar and wind. We've got about 5% that comes from traditional hydro. So of the electricity sector, we've got about 5 or 6 or 7% that comes from what we would call renewable energy sources. Of course, hydro cannot be expanded because we've run out of room for large dams.
Let alone your water supply in the current drought conditions.
And so we really need to expand our wind and solar energy in order to fulfill our energy requirements.
Okay, so on that note, let's introduce you as the author of the roadmap for a carbon-free, nuclear-free future for the United States. And let me just give a little history to our listeners. My institute, the Nuclear Policy Research Institute, I think 2 years ago, held a symposium or conference in Washington, D.C., actually at Ailey House, for 2 days called Nuclear Power and Global Warming. And at that conference, we invited experts from both sides of the issue, pro-nuclear people and anti-nuclear people, meteorologists and the like, to examine the whole thing. And at the end of the conference, Dave Freeman, who we've just discussed, who is Jimmy Carter's energy advisor and formerly the head of the Tennessee Valley Authority, he's a really funny, remarkable human being. He wears a big black cowboy hat, stood up and said, "We can produce all the energy that America needs, both for transportation and electricity, without any CO2 production and without any nuclear." And I responded and said, "You must be joking." And he said, "No, I'm absolutely serious." At which point, Arjun, you take it from here. I can't remember how actually you got recruited to do the study.
Well, he said that we should go to solar energy.
Yeah.
And at the time, I hadn't been looking at energy for some time, but I knew that solar energy was still quite expensive, or felt that. And I went up to him and I said, "You know, this is going to be too expensive to carry out, and you're going to send every industry we have left to China if we actually try to get this done." And that's how the discussion of a technical study actually got started. You were very excited by Dave's ideas about getting rid of fossil fuels and nuclear. I was too. But I just didn't think it could be done. So I went into the study as a skeptic, and we negotiated, and you agreed to raise the funds for it, and I agreed to do it. And both of you were on my advisory board.
And on your back, too.
And on my back, yes.
So it's probably about 9 months ago you actually produced this report, which I consider is the most remarkable report and the only roadmap of its kind in the world. I mean, the world leaders go to Bali and talk about global warming and climate change and the like and the like, and they talk about a roadmap in a sort of a vague, arbitrary way, but there is no roadmap. They have not one. But you've produced the roadmap that by the year 2050 could produce only for the United States almost all the electricity it needs without any CO2 production or nuclear waste, and all the transportation that America needs without using oil. So why don't you describe now, Arjun, the main points that arose from that study? In other words, give us a summary of what it says, and then we'll get into some details. And I want everyone to listen really carefully, because this roadmap is actually the prescription for survival. Everyone's throwing their hands up, James Hansen from NASA is saying that the Arctic ice is melting, not just him, but everyone else. And then the feedback loops will cause the Greenland ice to melt and the oceans will rise and there'll be millions of ecological refugees and epidemics of disease spreading like wildfire all over the world because of heating the planet and droughts and flooding rains and the like. So the roadmap couldn't be more important. And instead of saying, oh my God, it's gloom and doom, we've had it, you know, we'll destroy many species ourselves with them. Here's the prescriptions for survival. And if we take this seriously and get the politicians on track, we can save the planet from global warming. So let's have a summary, Arjun, of the main points, please. And this is Dr. Okay. Arjun Makajani, who wrote the roadmap, the seminal roadmap for carbon-free, nuclear-free future. And as you all listen to this, I want you to tape it or get a tape and send it out to all your friends and get this played on every single radio station in the country.
Well, here are the fundamentals. Efficiency is at the foundation. We currently waste most of the energy we use. The energy in the coal or nuclear fuel that actually comes out as light in an incandescent lamp is only 1%.
Describe how it's only 1% efficient. Of all the energy produced, you only get 1% efficiency in the incandescent bulb.
Yeah, so two-thirds of the energy in the coal or nuclear fuel is rejected as waste heat at the power plant.
Mm-hmm.
And so one-third becomes electricity and comes into your room through the wires.
Mm-hmm.
And that electricity goes through an incandescent lamp, and most of it, 97% of it, turns into heat, infrared heat, which you cannot see. And only 3% turns into visible photons and actually shines on something that gets reflected into your eyes, and then you can form an image of something. Now, we have more efficient lighting, compact fluorescents. So with compact fluorescents, about 10 or 12% of the electricity gets turned into light. So that means about 4% of the fuel gets turned into light. Now we have light-emitting diodes and other more advanced forms of lighting technology that can turn into electricity into light even more efficiently. And now we have ways of using optical fibers to bring sunshine indoors from the roof. So we can drastically improve the efficiency of lighting. Similarly, we can improve the efficiency of heating. Our natural gas heating systems, by the second law of thermodynamics, are only about 10% efficient. We can greatly increase that efficiency by using geothermal heat pumps, combined heat and power, and other technologies. We can use solar water heaters, both for water heating and space heating. Let me give you a specific example. In the average energy consumed by a U.S. household per square foot per year is 58,000 British thermal units. That's about 60 million joules per square foot. Per year. Now, if you look at Hanover House in New Hampshire, which is in a rather colder part of the United States, but no air conditioning, but colder than average, that is a well-built house. It didn't cost a lot, $111 a square foot, which is a moderate cost for a house, but it's very well built. It has south-facing windows. It's well insulated. It has what we call a high thermal mass. That is, when the sun shines on it, the walls become warm, and then at night they radiate heat into the house, and you don't need very much energy supply to keep your house warm, just for very prolonged cloudy periods. He's got a solar water heater and a 1,000-gallon buried tank, and that supplies the main heating and water heating. He's got very efficient appliances. So what's the net result of all of this? His energy consumption in Hanover House is 8,000 BTU per square foot.
Compared to?
Compared to 58,000 BTU per square foot. So one-seventh the average.
Mm.
So we can actually eliminate most of the coal and nuclear and oil and natural gas fuel requirements on the residential and commercial sectors through proper building design.
So architects have a huge responsibility, right?
They have a huge, and developers. The main problem is architects will do what developers want them to do. They get paid.
Yeah.
They get paid to build, to design the buildings that the person with the money orders them to design.
Right.
Developers want to sell buildings with granite counters and azaleas in their front yards. You know, the things that all of us like. We like beautiful, livable houses, and we don't really worry about energy bills or climate change when we're buying a house. Developers don't pay the energy bills, so they don't really care if they're high. We need rules, regulations for developers. You shall build houses that perform to the following BTU per square foot per year standard, according to climate.
It's really like a law, you've got to stop your car at a red light. And I think that these laws have to be enacted by Congress as soon as possible. And, you know, it reminds me of medicine, you know, and developers and architects. The architects are obliged to do what the developers ask them to do. It's like a patient saying, well, I want you to take out my appendix and anastomose my bowel in a certain way. But the patient doesn't know anything about surgery or medicine. They have no right or any knowledge to say a thing like that. Similarly, clients who are building houses and developers have no real knowledge about what is happening to the planet in a really complex way. And they don't have the answers, whereas architects do. And I think that architects have been irresponsible in not laying down the law, and as a whole group throughout the nation in the United States, to say we will not construct buildings, whether it's for industry, business or homes, that are energy inefficient, because things are too serious now.
I think you have a very good idea there. I think there ought to be, there are many architects now who are designing green buildings and efficient buildings, but there ought to be a certain set of professional standards, just like architects would not build buildings that are unsafe in terms of their natural gas supply or unsafe in terms of their structures or leaks of water. There ought to be planet safety rules currently, because I really have taken what you told me to heart, that the planet is in intensive care. And we need to behave as if the planet is in intensive care and take urgent measures to get it out of there.
Yeah.
And so I think we can't be waiting for the federal government to act forever, although that is very critical. There's no reason why professional organizations should not have normative rules that this is how professionals who are certified by the architectural community are expected to behave. I think that's a brilliant idea.
And also, you know, I think too many Americans don't realize the power they have over their own elected representatives. And in truth, when it boils down, the people are the leaders, and their representatives in Congress are their followers, and they are obliged to do what the people demand that they do. Now, in the absence of the people lobbying and being active, in move the lobbyists and the corporations and the like, and they get their way, and they've got loads of money, and we all know that. So the people in Congress are virtually bought off. But that doesn't mean to say that we can't regain the power over our elected representatives and say, look, the earth's dying. This isn't a thing to be mucking around with. And now we demand that you pass a law that every building that's built is an energy efficient building, and that we retrofit all the old buildings to become as energy efficient as they possibly could be.
Now, one of the things I've suggested in my book, it's harder to retrofit existing buildings and make it work at any old time. It's more expensive.
Yeah.
What I've suggested is
pull them all down.
We move a lot in the United States. We change houses a lot.
Yeah.
And at the time that you move, it's easier to invest and make that investment part of the new mortgage. You get your tax write-off. You get to borrow at a low interest rate. That's a fixed interest rate if you borrow for your mortgage at a fixed rate. And then you get to roll it into the cost of the new house. And if you invest in efficiency, the same way as you might invest, say, in radon remediation, and that is recommended in many areas, that would be a way to improve the existing stock of buildings.
Yeah.
We also ought to impose some requirements on landlords. So that sort of gives you an idea of what we need to do for buildings. We can do the same for appliances and we should do the same for vehicles. Our record on vehicle efficiency is quite lamentable.
Oh,
it's not
awful.
Very good anywhere. But in Japan, new cars are required to have 46 miles per gallon.
Yeah.
In the European Union, 43 miles per gallon.
Yeah.
And here, I think it's 25 or 27 miles per gallon. It's pretty pathetic.
It's extraordinary. And to think that, you know, Detroit has gotten away with this for so long. I'll tell you an anecdote. I was in San Francisco a couple of years ago staying at a hotel, and I got in the bus with other people to go to the airport. And I sat next to a man and I said, "What do you do?" And he said, "Well, I work for General Motors." And I said, "What are you still making these SUVs for?" I said, "You know, they do 10 miles a gallon, if that. They pump out huge amounts of CO2. You're adding to global warming." And he sort of looked at me and said, "Well, we're making money." And I said, "But you can't make money by destroying the earth." And suffice it to say, we got nowhere in this discussion. We didn't end up enemies, but we weren't close friends. And then, interestingly, in the time since then, Detroit's collapsing, and for good reason, because the Japanese are preempting the American auto manufacturers, right?
But, you know, even the Japanese don't behave very well here, although they market the Prius, and that's all to the good. But when it came to efficiency standards, Toyota was right in there with General Motors fighting them, because they make a lot more profit from SUVs
than
they do from cars.
It's obscene.
We need to overcome the power of these lobbies. And I think that there's actually quite a lot of hope in the last year, even on Capitol Hill, because for the first time, and you've been to Capitol Hill over the last year with me, and you've seen some of this yourself, is the discussion about global warming has become much more serious.
Yeah.
And I think just having a serious discussion about global warming in Washington and carbon dioxide limits has caused some eyebrows to be raised in Wall Street, which is very worried that, for instance, if they finance more coal-fired power plants, that they may face financial penalties a couple of years down the line. So now many of the coal-fired power plants that were on the drawing boards just 12 or 15 months ago have fallen off the drawing boards.
Mm.
They have been canceled. And we don't even have any legislation on climate as yet. So I think things are moving not as fast as we would like and not as well as we would like, but they are moving, even in Washington.
Well,
and I think the American public is waking up, and many American politicians are waking up.
I just would like to interrupt now and say this is Dr. Helen Caldicott of If You Love This Planet, interviewing Dr. Arjun Makhijani. To come back to that point, Arjun, about things aren't moving as fast as we like, I don't think it's us. I think, to use the analogy again, that the Earth is in the intensive care unit, and as James Hansen from NASA keeps saying, look, we're beyond the point of no return. I can't tell you how I feel in the weekends. I open up the newspapers and there's a thing that falls out, which is the auto sort of magazine full of advertisements for these cars like Audis and Maseratis and God knows what that use huge amounts of petroleum. And I just really feel as a physician that these ads have to be stopped. And I don't really care about the economy. If you talk about the earth surviving and you talk about the economy, and you can address this in a minute, of course, you can't say, well, we'll keep, you know, building these autos till the cars come home because we're making money out of them. It's like building nuclear weapons because we're making money out of them. The earth might blow up any day. Or we're building the autos because we're making money out of them and global warming will be a certainty and our children and grandchildren will have no future. From a medical perspective, I guess I see this, that there must be urgently laws enacted that these cars and autos cannot, and I stress cannot, be built anymore. I mean, you go to New York and there are these Hummers. People have Hummers driving their little girls to ballet in Hummers. I mean, what on earth are people doing? Is it a kind of manic denial? People are denying, you know, global warming so manically that they're into Hummers, or is it sort of displacement activity? If you put rats in a cage and threaten them with a lethal situation, they run away and do something irrelevant to that which threatens them. I mean, the psychology of this really takes my breath away and I don't understand it really.
Well, I can't claim to understand the psychology. I can tell you that for most people, global warming, even now, is not in the center of their attention. It's not in the center.
Why do you think that is?
Debate. I don't know. I don't understand the cycle. Most people don't read the newspapers. The media are controlled by large corporations.
Yes.
You know, so there's a whole host of interconnected problems that I must beg off, because I am certainly not an expert in them.
Yeah.
But what I can say is, even if people like Maseratis, we can make all electric Maseratis, which can be charged by solar photovoltaics, that will create zero CO2.
Why don't we get into plug-in hybrids, which is another part of your roadmap, Arjun? You've done buildings, you've done energy efficiency. Let's get into transportation now, and your solution for a carbon-free, nuclear-free world in terms of transportation.
We really need to move away from liquid fuel automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
We can. For the one of the revelations to me why I became convinced that we can move away from fossil fuels altogether was that we now have the battery technology to make vehicles that will go a couple of hundred miles on a charge, that can be charged quickly with heavy current equipment, and that can be charged frequently, and they won't wear out, unlike the current old batteries that we have, the lead-acid battery that starts our cars. There are new lithium-ion batteries that are made, for instance, by a company in Nevada called Altair Nano. They can be charged and discharged 10,000 times compared to 750 for a lead-acid battery. And they need to become a little bit cheaper, but today cars are being built. Pickup trucks actually are being built for fleets that can be charged in 10 minutes with heavy current equipment. Now, when you have a car like that, it's actually functional with the performance that we're used to. It creates no CO2 if you charge it from renewable sources. And moreover, because you don't need that many charges and discharges over the life of the car, 10,000, we only need about 3,000 over the life of a car. You can loan your batteries to the grid. So on our website, ieer.org, you'll see parking lots that have canopies of solar cells, so you're generating electricity and shading your parking spot at the same time. You can drive up into your parking spot, plug in your car, and this is currently being tested in Google, so it's not that it's pie-in-the-sky technology. This technology is here. You can connect your car to the grid. The grid operator can control the charge on the battery. You can either charge it or discharge it according to the needs of the grid and the needs of your car. And only a few percent of the cars need to be plugged in at any time to have a storage mechanism for solar energy. So here's a scheme for the electricity sector. Much or most of the U.S. electricity requirements can be supplied simply by putting solar photovoltaics on the rooftops of commercial buildings and the parking lots of commercial buildings. Google actually supplies, I think, 30% of its electricity requirements just from its rooftops. And this is becoming more and more common. The largest such project was announced this month, I think, or last month, 240 megawatts in Southern California. And one of the great advantages of installing solar cells on parking lots and commercial rooftops, you get economies of scale, but you don't need to build new transmission lines because you're building the electricity system right where the demand is.
And then you can plug your car in,
right,
charge it up, and then take it home and plug it into your house and charge up your house, right?
Right. You can charge your house. You could also possibly use the charge on the batteries to run your house, but you could also have solar cells on your house to run your house. And the whole thing would operate as what we call the distributed grid, that there would be small, medium, and large-scale power sources operating together in a way that to replace the mainly centralized grid that we have today. Not that we won't have centralized plants. We will have some. For instance, recently, Arizona Public Service, which is a utility in Arizona, signed a contract with a Spanish company to supply solar thermal electricity. Now, this is a power plant that will be built in the desert where solar energy will shine on parabolic reflectors, heat up oil, which will be used to generate steam and which will drive a steam turbine and create electricity. You can also store the hot oil or molten salt, and then you can generate electricity from that at night when the sun is not shining because you've stored the heat.
Mm.
Now, you can combine sources like that with solar photovoltaics, with storage in lithium-ion batteries and cars, as well as wind energy to create a completely renewable electricity system. Actually, solar thermal is about the same price as nuclear today. Wind energy is cheaper than nuclear today. New nuclear power plants are estimated to be quite expensive, even by the industry, $5,000 to $8,000 a kilowatt.
Mm. Well, it's tremendously exciting. So that's buildings, efficiency, transportation.
We didn't get all of transportation yet because
okay.
We haven't talked about aircraft.
And we also didn't talk about ethanol and how detrimental it is to feed cars and not people. And we're now seeing right now people who are starving in many countries of the world because the price of food has gone up, partly because America's growing a lot of corn for ethanol, which is very inefficient anyway in its own way. And I'd like you to talk a little about ethanol replacing gasoline for cars, and then we want to get into the next subject.
Yeah. Fortunately, right now people are realizing that it's a very bad thing to turn fuel into food and then food back into fuel, that it's very inefficient. It doesn't do a whole lot to protect climate or reduce greenhouse gas emissions. If anything, the effect is very modest, and in some cases, like turning palm oil from Indonesia into biodiesel, the effect is actually grossly negative. That is, you're emitting more greenhouse gases. And then, of course, now it has been recognized to contribute to food shortages and price
right.
increases, and there are riots in many countries.
Right.
This was not unforeseen. I actually quoted studies in my book that predicted that there would be shortages of food if we emphasize, and this is not the only cause of food price increases.
No.
And there are other causes.
Yes.
But this is definitely one of the significant causes because we're using a very large amount of corn and smaller amounts of other grains
to drive cars.
To convert them into ethanol.
So, I want to get into aircraft transportation. And then in the last few minutes, I want you to talk about how the roadmap for a carbon-free, nuclear-free future has been received by Congress and state governments. So can you do aircraft now briefly and then the reception of the roadmap, please?
Yeah. We will need some liquid fuels for industry, for aircraft, and so on.
Hmm.
There are a couple of ways to do this. We can convert wind energy by electrolysis into hydrogen. We can convert solar energy directly into hydrogen. Those technologies are a little bit far off, especially solar energy into hydrogen. So we may need some biofuels. There are sound ways to produce biofuels. They're not completely economical yet. They need to be developed, and that's why government needs to be building large demonstration plants. But my central recommendation has been to grow aquatic weeds. Aquatic weeds are very efficient gatherers of solar energy. They can be used to clean up wastewater, for instance. Duckweed and water hyacinths will sop up the extra nutrients in wastewater and prevent eutrophication of water systems. And you can get 10,000 gallons an acre from aquatic weeds and microalgae, while you'll get only a few hundred gallons per acre from corn.
Of ethanol, yeah.
Yeah. So there are ways to produce liquid fuels for industry and for aircraft and some other applications that we will need. And that is described in my book. I mean, my book has been reasonably well received. I think the power of the lobbies is on display in Congress. But despite that, it is slowly being considered by more and more Congress people. I've distributed my book. You yourself have gone around the Hill promoting it in key congressional offices. More importantly, I'm going around the country talking about my book. I've talked about it with, you know, in governor's offices. I've talked about it with grassroots groups. What we're trying to do, Helen, in the United States is to create a huge movement for a carbon-free and nuclear-free economy. We've got a statement of principles that has been signed by 100 organizations, and people are very, very excited that there is a set of solutions. People are tired of gloom and doom. You know, you can only hear so many times that Florida will disappear from the map, and then you stop paying attention. So I've been received like as the savior prince.
A knight in shining armor.
Yeah. It's an unusual role for me.
Yeah, well, but I just want to say, you know, Arjun is really an Indian prince and a knight in shining armor. And he really has produced the solution to global warming, which can be enacted by 2050 in the United States. And as the United States is the prototype, sets a role model for the rest of the world, including China with 1.3 billion people, India with 1.2 billion people, and the like. If the United States changes, and furthermore, the GDP will go up, millions of people will be employed producing solar cells and panels and windmills and the like, and that technology will then be exported to the rest of the world, and we can actually save the planet. I think this is one of the most exciting, if not the most exciting, publication to have been produced for I can't tell you how long. A roadmap for carbon-free, nuclear-free future, which you can actually get at the IEER.org website. Or, Arjun, would you like to have the last word?
Yeah, you can download it free, courtesy of Helen, from our website, IEER.org. You can purchase it. And, you know, this is the economy of the future. We've been spending $250 billion importing oil in this country, and all of that money can be used to create really good renewable energy jobs right here.
Well, look, Arjun, one of my heroes, I want to congratulate you and thank you very much for appearing on the show, If You Love This Planet, Dr. Arjun Makhijani, who's the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research and will be one of the heroes of the 21st century, I predict and believe. So thank you, Arjun, for being with us today.
If that comes to pass, it will be because of you. Thank you, Helen.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
My guest is Arjun Makhijani, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Arjun is the author of Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a roadmap for US energy policy, which you can actually get at IEER.org. I'm about to play an excerpt from a lecture I gave in 2007 to an audience of early childhood experts and teachers in Brisbane, Australia.
Well, I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to be addressing an audience who care about children. I've been addressing some business audiences recently about the future in terms of global warming and other catastrophes. And really, their bottom line is money. And as I've said to people who make nuclear weapons in the past, but what about your children? And they look at me with eyes like dead stones and say, but I'm making money. And it's not until those people are on their deathbed themselves, or their child's been diagnosed with cystic fibrosis, which is my specialty, or leukemia, that they actually fall into my arms and weep, and their souls become exposed, and their psychic numbing drops away. I think that your profession, your love and care and attention to the new generation is imperative. For as when you go to Cuba, there are big signs all along the road saying, our children are our national treasure. And the children come out of little barrios, little dirt barrios, in beautifully starched iron clothes and go to school. The education system there is excellent. There's virtually no illiteracy. There was before the revolution. It was ubiquitous. And the healthcare system is probably the best in the world because of education. So the work you do in grounding the children when they're very small and then going on to develop a decent educational system, which we don't see too much of today in our present Australian economic rationalist system, is imperative for our future. But then, of course, we've got to look at our children's future. do they have a safe future? And it's very clear at the moment they do not. With the International Panel on Climate Change, three reports that have just come out recently, each sentence vetted by about 20 scientists, the prognosis for the Earth is not good. That within 50 years, about 30% of the world's species may become extinct. Those are our children's heritage, along with many hundreds of millions of people, as epidemics of malaria and encephalitis rage around the planet as the tropics enlarge north and south, as the forests are all chopped down, and incidentally we're still chopping forests down in Tasmania and in Queensland, when we should be saving the forests because they're the lungs of the earth, which inhale carbon dioxide, the global warming gas, and excrete oxygen. Apart from the extinction of the species, people will be displaced as ecological refugees. There are 4 million refugees, you know, from Iraq at the moment, but that's nothing compared to the hundreds of millions that will be displaced by floods, drowning Bangladesh and drowning very large surfaces of the earth. So talk about refugees, we haven't seen anything yet. Now, is there a solution to the problem of global warming? Absolutely. I held a conference in Washington last year called Nuclear Power and Global Warming, from which came this book that I wrote. And if you want to sort of check up on what I'm telling you today or research more deeply the facts, this book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer to Global Warming, has an awful lot of medical information in it. So what we've done is put together a roadmap for a carbon-free, nuclear-free future for the United States by the year 2050. Now everyone's talking about 60% reduction in CO2. You'll read this in the paper by 2050, maybe 80%. We can get it down to 90%, almost zero. How, one might ask? Well, the technology is available, and here right now, look at our country. We are bathed in sun. The other thing is that we're absolutely bathed in wind, and wind power can supply huge amounts of electricity. There's enough wind west of the Mississippi in the United States to supply 2.5 times the electricity America currently needs. The technology's here, it's extremely cheap compared to nuclear, yet it's not being tapped because who funds the anti-wind campaign in Australia is the nuclear industry in the United States. What we need to do is follow the money. I'm speaking now as a pediatrician caring deeply about the future of our children, to whom we are absolutely and totally devoted. So the answers are here. All we need is to educate our politicians and the general public for, as President Jefferson said years ago, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. And unfortunately, at the moment, our democracy is ill-informed.
That was an excerpt from a lecture I gave in 2007 at an early childhood conference in Brisbane, Australia. We rely on donations to keep this important show on air. If you would like to contribute, please go to ifyouloveisplanet.org. That's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us on If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and I look forward to your company next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is recorded at 2XX FM Community Radio in Canberra, Australia, and produced by Scott Powell, Amanda Bellerby, and Jasmine Williams. For more information on this program, to listen to previous shows, or to make a donation, visit our website at ifyoulovethisplanet.org.